Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but...
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns and the Rivertown Kids, the Solartopia song. Boy, we miss Pete, don't we? What a great guy he was, and what a wonderful time it was when they sang this song. We are also on now with a truly great woman, one of the most important women on the planet in terms of what she's done to save our species and our ability to continue to live on this planet Earth, increasingly diminished, the wonderful Dr. Helen Caldicott. Helen, are you with us?
I am, Javi.
And you are in my hometown, my birthplace of Boston, Massachusetts.
That's
is that right. Right?
That's right. I am with my grandchildren.
All right. So, Helen, the really important thing is we want to find out from you is how many grandchildren you got, and what are their names?
I've got seven. So, Mikhail, Rachel, Paul, Oscar, Tess, Claire, and Liam.
Fantastic. And, of course, Mikhail is named after the great Kevin Mikhail, formerly of the Boston Celtics. Is that right?
No, he's not. You see, he's named after Gorbachev.
Oh, it's Mikhail Gorbachev. Well, it's in Boston, it's tough to differentiate in terms of the greatness scale.
Yeah, I know. Boston people have blinkers on.
Between Mikhail Gorbachev and Kevin Mikhail, since Kevin helped bring them a couple of titles to the NBA. So, Helen, what brings you to the United States from your home in Australia?
Well, to see my grandchildren, but also I've been lecturing. I've got a new book that's just come out called Crisis Without End, and it is the proceedings of the symposium that I held last year at the New York Academy of Medicine on the second anniversary of Fukushima, and it's the medical and the ecological consequences of Fukushima. And I brought in some of the best scientists in the world, epidemiologists, evolutionary biologists, oceanographers, physicians, and the like. And it was really a spectacular conference. I hoped to be able to educate the media, but of course the mainstream media did not turn up. Now,
Helen, let me just interrupt and tell you that I do not refer to the corporate media as the mainstream media. We are the mainstream media, CBS, NBC, ABC, that is the corporate media, and they don't cover anything except the latest, greatest, great breaking corporate news.
Yeah,
Progressive Radio Network, we are
Post
the mainstream.
A bit of good stuff. And I was hoping to attract Matt Wald from the New York Times, who does all the nuclear reporting, but he happened, I think, to go that weekend to a pro-nuclear conference. So you can't win them all, huh?
Well, we do win our share. We win a few. And last year, of course, we did shut four commercial reactors in the United States, the two at San Onofre in California, Kewaunee in Wisconsin, and Crystal River in Florida. We did have a little help from the industry itself, which poked three holes in the containment dome at Crystal River, could no longer sustain Kewaunee, and destroyed their own steam generators at San Onofre. This year, as you know, Helen, the Vermont Yankee reactor is on its way down to full shutdown, and that'll put us under 100 reactors in the United States for the first time in decades. We'll be at 99, and then we've got to start shutting them down from there. So tell us a bit more about this conference, and tell us also what has happened since this conference at Fukushima.
Well, we had two excellent nuclear engineers, Arne Gundersen and Dave Lochbaum, who talked about the accident itself, how the earthquake incurred damage to the reactors. There were six reactors operating. No, actually five.
Four. Oh, three.
Okay, five and six were not operating.
Neither was and Unit 4 was also in they were in refueling. So yes, but they did have they did manage to have their core 100 feet in the air. Small detail.
The point is that when the earthquake occurred, the external electricity supply, which supplies the power to pump 1 million gallons of water through each of the reactors per minute, was lost. And then because they thought, or they had worked out that that could happen, they had a whole series of diesel generators, each the size of a house, underneath the reactors. But then in came the tsunami and drowned the diesel generators. They were so desperate to get the pumps going that people were running out and getting the batteries from their cars. But
well, let's comment before we lose this on the great genius of the designers of the nuclear plant to put the backup power in danger from tsunamis. It's not as if they didn't know that tsunamis could come through there. I was in Japan in the mid-70s. I know you've been in Japan many times prior to Fukushima. And they were told, the designers of these reactors were told many times that it might not be a good idea to put backup generators where they could be wiped out by a tsunami. But, of course, they knew better.
Well, actually, I know the three GE engineers who designed the reactors, and they resigned in 1975 because they said the reactors were so dangerous. They testified before Congress. It was a big story, but, of course, it made absolutely no difference to what was happening. The people, I think, who should be sued are General Electric, because they built these reactors. TEPCO took over. But, you know, they excavated the cliff. They could have built them on the top of a cliff so they were not subject to flooding from the tsunami, but they didn't. And the other thing to point out is that if the accident had occurred at night, not Friday afternoon, but at night, when there would have been only 100 people at the Fukushima Daiichi reactor, then it would have been, all hell would have broken loose. All hell. And also, just down the coast is the Fukushima Daiichi 4 reactors, and they were in trouble too. So the truth is, if the accident, the tsunami and earthquake had occurred at night, it would have been probably, as David Suzuki in Canada says, bye-bye Japan. So just they escape by the skin of their teeth. It doesn't mean to say that there are not going to be huge numbers of people developing cancer, leukemia, genetic diseases and the like down the time track through the generations, actually, and that much of the food in Japan is radioactive. Parts of Tokyo are more radioactive than areas around Chernobyl, which are exclusion zones because they're so radioactive. So there are 35 million people living in Tokyo, many of whom are subjected to ongoing radiation on a daily basis. A doctor recently reported that children in those areas have very low white cell counts, below normal, that they are developing a lot of infections, hand, foot, mouth disease, pneumonia, you name it. And people are developing nosebleeds, some people are developing hair loss, which is symptomatic of radiation poisoning.
This is going on right now downwind from Fukushima?
Well, yeah. On the west coast, the winds blow from east to west across the Pacific Ocean, and there's a huge plume of radioactive material in the water heading towards the west coast. It's just starting to hit now, I think. But the point about that is two things. A, the Pacific is a huge body of water to dilute the radiation, but B, the radioactive elements, strontium, cesium, tritium, americium, etc., bioconcentrate up the food chain by orders of magnitude from algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, and us. And we can't taste radioactive elements in the food. We can't smell it and we can't see it. It's an invidious, silent, cryptogenic killer. And we already, tuna have been found in California carrying cesium from Fukushima, and that will get worse because there's absolutely no way that they can prevent the 300 to 400 tons of very high radioactive water flowing into the Pacific every day from those reactors, and that has been happening over the last 3.5 years. And the reason is because the reactors were built in front of a mountain range, and water pours down from the mountains beneath the reactors out to the sea, which was fine when the reactors were intact. But three of the reactor cores melted down. 100 tons of uranium turned into a molten volcanic radioactive lava, melted their way through 6 inches of steel and onto the containment vessel floor, where there are cracks, or we're not sure, because they may have melted into the earth, which is what the nuclear industry calls the China syndrome. So consequently, what happens is hundreds of tons of water pour down from the mountains on a daily basis. They wash over these cores, enriching the water with radioactive elements from the cores. And so they're trying to filter the water. And what Arne Gundersen, the nuclear engineer, says, well, the filters are actually becoming the cores, because they're getting all the elements from the cores. And then you've got to work out where on earth to put the filters, which are very radioactive. The other point is that no one can get near the radioactive cores. It's so radioactive that robots fail and humans would die very quickly if they went near the cores. No one knows where they are. TEPCO is operating a sort of an operation just to keep things looking good. They have subcontracted the workers to the Japanese mafia, which does a lot of nuclear subcontracting in Japan. So they're bringing in homeless people from the streets, mentally retarded people, alcoholics, to work at Fukushima Daiichi to hold things at bay. But, you know, there are pipes, there are plastic pipes held together with duct tape. A rat ate through some wiring a while ago and stopped the cooling system per se. Hydrogen is building up in three of the reactors, units 1, 2, and 3, so they're injecting nitrogen into the hydrogen to prevent the hydrogen exploding again like it did. There were 4 explosions, one of which was probably nuclear. The whole thing is a total, absolute disaster. They're running out of warm bodies to administer anything at the plant. People are getting very high radiation doses. The workers, they're not being followed up medically at all, nor being compensated for the radiation they receive. What TEPCO is trying to do is to maintain its sort of appearance so the shares don't fall. It's more important to keep the TEPCO shares high than it is to try and alleviate the situation. But actually, most nuclear experts say that the Fukushima situation will never be alleviated. The food in much of Fukushima Prefecture is radioactive, but the farmers are being encouraged to grow their rice and grow their vegetables. And in fact, they're selling them in London at the market. They're selling them in Tokyo. They're selling, and the food is being exported to America because Hillary Clinton signed an agreement just after the accident that America would keep importing Japanese food. The fish, a lot of the fish are radioactive, the seaweed's radioactive down the East Coast. Do not buy any Japanese food. No miso, no fish, no seaweed, no rice, no nothing, because you don't know where the food has been sourced from and whether or not it's radioactive. The last point I'll make quickly is that cancer takes from 2 to 80 years to incubate. Measles is 3 weeks, mumps is 3 weeks, common cold is 2 days, influenza is 2 days, but cancer is a long latent period. And you don't know you've been irradiated, and you don't know when the cancer arises. It doesn't wear a little sign saying, I was made by some cesium and a piece of fish you ate 20 years ago. So it's a deadly silent killer. But this is a problem of global proportions. And if there's another earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, Building 4 could collapse. Building 3, which has a huge cooling pool of much spent fuel on top of it, radioactive fuel, could collapse. The fuel would probably alight, producing a radioactive volcano, and the building would collapse also onto the molten corium or the melted fuel at the bottom of it, and God knows what that would do. If that happened, much of the northern hemisphere could be polluted with a lot of radioactive fallout. And, you know, earthquakes occur there all the time. In fact, just in the last day, a huge typhoon has just passed over the Fukushima damaged reactors, and we have no idea what impact that's had.
We're talking with Helen, Dr. Helen Caldicott. Helen, what's the name of your new book?
Crisis Without End, published by the New Press, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima.
All right. Helen Caldicott, the great Australian doctor who's been with the nuclear issue for God knows how long. How long, actually?
43 Helen, years, Harvey.
What year did you get involved with the nuclear power
1971, issue? When I led the movement in Australia to stop the French testing their bombs in the Pacific in the atmosphere because we were getting quite a high fallout in Adelaide.
Okay, and so this rundown of Fukushima is pretty terrifying. Of course, we are in the United States now gearing up to fight the two reactors at Diablo Canyon. I was arrested there in 1984. I had a wonderful three nights, actually, in the San Luis Obispo County Jail. I'm going to go back to San Luis Obispo, actually, in a week or 10 days and speak. We are gearing up a campaign now to shut these two reactors, which have been open for 30 years and which do sit on a cliff, but in a zone surrounded by five earthquake faults. Helen, the earthquake that destroyed Fukushima, that caused the typhoon, the tsunami, and but also that did so much damage to the reactors themselves, was 120 kilometers away from Fukushima. But the San Andreas Fault, the best known of the West Coast earthquake faults in California, is only 45 miles away from Fukushima, about half as far. From
Diablo
Canyon.
Canyon.
And there are four other known significant earthquake faults within a few miles, actually, of the Diablo Canyon reactors. Can you tell us, in your inimitable graphic detail, what would happen if a major earthquake hit, well, let's say an earthquake the size of the one that caused the Fukushima tsunami to hit at Diablo Canyon within a few miles?
Are there two reactors there, Harvey, at Diablo Canyon, the 1,000 megawatt reactors?
Yes, they're more than that, there are two of them. In fact, I'll look it up while we Google here their exact size.
And an enormous amount of radioactive nuclear waste and spent fuel. Well, I'm afraid that much of California would go. I mean, if it really, if a Fukushima happened at Diablo Canyon, it's interesting, it's called Diablo Canyon, which means Devil's Canyon.
Yeah, well, we're now calling them the Devil's Nukes.
Yeah, well, Devil's Canyon. And Nixon used to live just near them, incidentally. It depends upon the wind direction. It depends upon if there were fires, if the fuel caught fire. It depends upon the damage of the reactor. If the reactor, if the two reactors melted down, there'd be... Are they Mark 1 GE reactors?
No, these are Westinghouse reactors. The unit 1 is 1122 megawatts.
Yeah.
It went online in May of 1985, and unit 2 is 1118 megawatts, and it went online in March of 86.
Anyway, suffice it to say, you know, if they had some decent meltdowns and the wind was blowing over California, which is pretty densely populated in some parts, hundreds of or thousands of people would develop acute radiation illness within 2 weeks, with their hair falling out, vomiting, diarrhea, and bleeding to death, or dying of infections. And that's the way people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki died. It was a new illness called acute radiation illness, and that's what we would see. And then within 2 to 4 years, there would be an increased incidence of thyroid cancers, which we're now seeing in Fukushima, amongst the children under the age of 18. 103 now have thyroid cancers, and the normal incidence in that population is 1 or 2 per million. So we'd see an increased incidence markedly of thyroid cancers, particularly in children who are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. There would be a lot of spontaneous abortions because the developing fetus would be damaged by radiation. Also, those fetuses who survived would have lower than normal IQs because the developing brain is very sensitive to radiation. And that's what happened in many parts after of Europe, after Chernobyl, Sweden and Belarus and the like, then leukemia would start developing in many thousands of people 5 to 10 years later, and solid cancers would start appearing in every organ of the body because radiation affects all organs. I mean, I'm not saying that a person would get cancer in all their organs, but any organ can develop cancer post-radiation exposure. So we would see a huge increased incidence of cancers in the exposed population. What's more, California being the food bowl of America, the food, depending if it rained and the rain brought down the radiation plume in the air, the food would become fairly radioactive, and that's very serious because the food is exported all over America. What's more, if there was a really big fire there and a meltdown, the plume of radiation would be lifted into the higher levels of the atmosphere and would blow right across America and would come down as snow or rain or the like. So it would be an absolutely terrifying situation, and I think that the nuclear situation in America about meltdowns is not if but when.
What makes you say that? There are 99, after Vermont Yankee goes down, there are 99 reactors operating in the U.S. or licensed to operate, let's put it that way, because many of them are down much of the time. And then five, if you count the one in Tennessee, under construction. So tell us about the overall situation in the United States.
Well,
given
the overall
that fleet.
Situation is many of the reactors are reaching their use-by dates. They were designed to operate for about 40 years. After that, the metal pipes become very embrittled, very fragile from constant neutron irradiation. And what they're doing, you see, the nuclear power industry and weapons industry is a socialized industry. It's funny that America thinks it's capitalistic and they don't like socialism, but the truth is you're a socialistic country because 50% of your discretionary taxes go to the military-industrial complex for killing, and that socializes. Socialized Pentagon, socialized Lockheed Martin, socialized Boeing, and a socialized nuclear power industry. So you are a socialistic country. That's the truth, and it's very fascinating to me that people don't really understand that, yet you have no free medical care, so it's capitalism for all the poor little people. Anyway, because the utilities...
Well, Helen, what we have actually is corporate socialism or national socialism.
Well, that's what
Theodore Roosevelt actually used the term national socialism, which, of course, was picked up by the Nazis, but that's what he described the American system as.
Yeah. So anyway, let's go on. Because everything is paid for by the federal government, mining, milling, enriching the uranium, making the uranium fuel rods, building the reactor, et cetera, and the insurance, if there's a meltdown, is covered by the people, tax dollars. But once a utility gets hold of the reactor and it starts operating, they earn about $1 million a day. So they're very keen to keep going. So what they're doing is two things. They're extending the lifespan for another 20 years, which makes it terribly dangerous, one. Two, they're increasing the power output. Instead of having 3% enriched uranium, they're raising up to 3.5 or 4%, which makes the reactor as it fissions actually vibrate. And as it vibrates, it sort of can, sort of, the pipes, the cooling pipes, etc., could disintegrate. It's terribly, terribly dangerous. But really, the utilities don't care about the people. They just care about their $1 million a day. It's obscene. It is obscene. Furthermore, about 30 tons of radioactive waste are removed from every reactor per year. That's now, you've got about nearly 80,000 tons, probably, of radioactive waste with nowhere to put it from the civilian nuclear power program, let alone even more from the weapons program. There's nowhere to put it. There was a facility in Carlsbad, New Mexico, called WIP, and it was they dug huge caves in salt mines, and salt is very stable unless it gets wet and then it dissolves. And these salt mines had been there, not mines, but salt deposits, for millions of years. So they dug huge caverns, and they're putting very, very radioactive material in there, saying this will last forever. Well, guess what? One of the containers with very nasty radiation in it, plutonium, americium, I mean deadly, deadly radioactive material, has exploded and contaminated the whole area, the whole site. I predict they'll never use it again. Yucca Mountain didn't work out because the people in Nevada didn't want it. It would have been built over an aquifer. Yucca Mountain is composed of volcanic ash, pumice, and so it's very permeable, and the aquifer over which it sits supplies Las Vegas with water. So that's not going to work. So any container you put radioactive waste in, be it titanium, steel, concrete, will within 100 years or less break, crack, and allow the radiation to escape into underground water systems, and it will eventually percolate up to the streams and rivers, be used to water the food, and the food will inevitably, over time, generations, become more and more radioactive. And you can imagine people generations hence waking up in the morning. Their babies may be being born deformed, as they are and have been after Chernobyl. The children, some will have an increased incidence of genetic diseases like diabetes, cystic fibrosis, phenylketonuria, hemochromatosis. There are over 2,600 such diseases because nuclear isotopes or radiation produces random compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time. The breast milk will be radioactive. The babies or children will be getting cancer at the age of 6 instead of 60 because they're exposed to radioactive elements in utero. Now, we're not the only ones with genes. We're not the only ones who get cancer. The 30 million other species on Earth who cohabit the planet with us also have genes and also get cancer and can have their genes mutated. So what we're doing is damaging the positive process of evolution. And I'll just end this diatribe by saying that nuclear power plants are cancer factories and bomb factories, because any country that has a nuclear reactor makes 500 pounds of plutonium a year, and you need 10 pounds to make an atomic bomb. So the nuclear power industry in this country, in its wisdom, and in Japan and elsewhere, Canada, is selling reactors around the world as fast as it can go to United Arab Emirates and Vietnam and all sorts of countries, and they have then will have enough plutonium to make bombs for the next 500,000 years, because that's how long the plutonium lasts. So it's all a great idea, you know, bomb factories and cancer factories.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, the great nuclear expert.
Are you there? Hello?
Concert, fabulous gathering in New York City. And we are going to take a break now. Helen, you'll stay with us, of course, we hope, for the next half hour. We've got much more to talk about. I want to start talking with you about renewable energy as well. So if we can come back now, we'll listen to the Solartopia Rocky Top version from Dana Lyons, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with another half hour Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Sweet home to me, Solartopia. That's the future for me. Green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast. That's the future for me. Green-powered energy. Roll it up, for you and me.
Woo is right. That's the great Dana Lyons, my good buddy of Cows with Guns fame, up to over 2 million hits on Cows with Guns. We are back with the great Helen Caldicott, Dr. Helen Caldicott, a native of Australia, been with the anti-nuclear movements since 1971, one of the few who's been in it that long. My God, Helen, you don't look a day over 20. and just telling us in excruciating detail what we're really looking at with nuclear power. We do have good news, Helen. I just put out a new poster, King Kong meets Solartopia. We do have good news in the renewable energy industry, and tremendous breakthroughs being made every day. Can you tell us what's going on in Australia with renewables? Now, you have managed to keep commercial reactors out of Australia entirely, and they must be getting their energy somewhere. So tell us about that.
Oh, we're in a desperate plight. I'm really ashamed to be Australian, I have to tell you, Harvey. We've got a very frightful Prime Minister who's worse than the Tea Party.
There seem to be a bunch of those around right now. We got David Cameron, who's completely awful in Great Britain. We have this guy in Canada, whose name thankfully escapes me at the moment. And, we're looking at a lot of governors. I live in Ohio, who's kind of with John Kasich, who's kind of in the same loathsome spiral. So what do you got going in Australia?
Well, this man, Tony Abbott, and his people in the cabinet in the parliament is just terrible. He just opened a huge new coal mine and said the future is in coal. He is hosting a G20 meeting. He said if Putin turns up, he'll shirt front him. Shirt front means rip the shirt off him, because he says Putin killed all those people in the plane crash. There's no evidence of that. We don't know who fired that rocket. But more than that, he's removing all the funding that was set up by the Green Party and the Labor Party for renewable energy production. Now, Australia is one big desert. It's the same size as the US in area. It only has about 22 million people. It is bathed in sun and blown by wind. There's absolutely no reason why solar panels shouldn't be on every single house in Australia, so they're all totally independent from the big corporations. The way we generate electricity now is we burn filthy coal, brown coal, which makes terrible acid rain, and we're digging up coal all over the country in beautiful agricultural areas where we grow wine and we grow beautiful racehorses and stuff. They're just opening up huge coal pits. We are digging up uranium, and the uranium in Fukushima was Australian uranium. We have wind, so much wind you can't believe it. It is obscene what is happening. We could be the energy superpower of the world. And instead of this, we've got these troglodytes, literally troglodytes that come out of caves. His IQs must be pretty down low. Pushing coal export. And they want to send ships full of coal through the Great Barrier Reef, which is one of the great wonders of the world. Unbelievable what they're doing. And I get no say in Australia. I don't know. I'm seen as some sort of alarmist or something.
Weren't they going to build a giant solar tower in Australia? What happened with that project?
Oh, well, I think that's off the boil now. The government's pulling all funding for solar. And they subsidize coal, uranium mining, and we mine, of course, huge amounts of iron ore, which we send off to China. We're really just one big quarry. That's what Australia is. We export raw material and import finished goods. We are so pathetic. And yet we used once to be a nation of great initiative and creativity. But unfortunately, I think, Murdoch owns 75% of our newspapers now, and you know what Murdoch does with the media. And so people are kind of brainwashed, and and they're not really educated about the dangers of global warming. I mean, Mr. and Mrs. Brown and Mr. and Mrs. Green, I don't think they really understand what the future means to their children, that if we continue the way we're going, by the end of this century, it'll be 6 degrees centigrade hotter or 10 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, temperatures with which we cannot survive. We cannot survive. You've just had a new grandchild. I've got seven. And as a paediatrician, having taken the Hippocratic Oath, all the world's children are potentially my patients. So what I try and do, and you do too, Harvey, is practice global preventive medicine. But boy, we're up against very stiff opposition.
And it's corporate opposition, basically. I mean, what we now have now is really this rampant cancer called the corporation, which is a virus, I suppose, that you could call it, which has human rights but no human responsibilities. And all these.
Well, it's worse than Ebola.
Yes, it definitely much more contagious. And, you know, all these horrible prime ministers, you know, from David Canyon to Stephen Harper, that's the guy's name in Canada, to your guy in Australia, and many, many, many of the governors now in the United States. And in the wings, of course, we have Jeb Bush, who would be the ultimate corporate criminal, and Mitt Romney waiting to take over. You know, this is the plague of the corporation.
Yeah, I know. But look, this is still a democracy in name, not in action. But what people don't understand is democracy doesn't mean voting once every 2 or 4 years and lots of people deign not to vote. How dare people not vote in America? If they don't vote here, they should go and live in a country where they have a dictator. You're so lucky to have a democracy here. And what people do not understand is that the politicians are your representatives. You are their leaders. The president is your representative. You pay for him.
The problem, Helen, and of course, living in Columbus, Ohio, election theft capital of the 2004 election, is that while people on the surface have the right to vote, they don't have the right to have their votes counted. And that's a really big problem that we're going to have to work our way through.
The point I want to make, Harvey, is that it's imperative that your politicians be educated. As Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And so, therefore, it is imperative that every time your politician comes back to the district, which is often once a week or once every fortnight, you go and see him or her. You take my book, Crisis Without End, and you go and take doctors and educate them. And you say to them, if you don't vote the way we want you to represent us and our children, we'll make sure you don't get elected next time. Then you go out and put on your sneakers and you go out and you door knock the whole electorate and teach the people in your electorate what your politician represents, not the children of the electorate or the public health of the electorate, but the health of the corporations. Now, that means putting your body on the line, means getting out there, and sitting on Twitter and Facebook will do not one tiny, tiny bit of good. And if you do that and you're successful, you see, then you become news. And then they will report what you're doing.
Well, listen, Helen, you are a veteran of one of the most amazing confrontation. I won't call, maybe meetings we can call it, somewhere between a meeting and a confrontation. You were actually escorted into the White House, as I understand it, by Patty Davis, the daughter of Ronald Reagan, to talk about nuclear war and nuclear weapons. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, well, I met Patty Davis when I spoke at the Playboy Mansion along with Paul Newman to a whole lot of film stars, because Playboy was going to excerpt the book called With Enough Shovels. And there was a man called T.K. Jones in FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, who said, don't worry about nuclear war. If we've got enough shovels to go around, we'll all make it. And what you do is, when the missiles are hurtling towards you, and it only takes half an hour to go from Russia to America, incidentally, there are 40 hydrogen bombs targeted on New York as I speak, and 60 on Washington. So who are the real terrorists, Russia and America, threatening to blow up the planet? Anyway, T.K. Jones said, if you've got enough shovels, when the missiles are coming, you dig a hole 6 feet by 4 feet and you get in your hole and you put two doors on top and you put dirt on top of the hole. And then someone said, well, who puts the dirt on top of your hole? And some comic said, your mother-in-law does, which is a narcissistic joke. But it was so ludicrous that they were publishing this book. And I spoke, you know, with Paul, who was gorgeous. And this tall girl came up afterwards and said, I think you're the only person on earth who can change my father's mind. And so we got an appointment with Reagan at the end of his working day, which happened to be 4 o'clock. And we swept into the southern portico and we met
him. I thought that was the beginning of his working day.
No. We swept into the southern portico and met in the library where there were no books. He took a while to come in. He was very dithery, didn't know where to sit. I showed him, I shook his hand and said, hello, Mr. President. He didn't, you know, come up to shake my hand. And we sat down, as I told him where to sit. And then I said, well, you probably don't know who I am, do you? And he said, yes. He said, you're an Australian pediatrician who is scared of nuclear weapons, but our ways to prevent it differ. I believe in building more bombs. So we were off to a flying start. And I spent an hour...
What year was this, Helen? What year did you meet Reagan?
82. And, I spent an hour and a quarter with him. The longest any single person spent with him during his whole presidency. He got quite anxious and uptight when I challenged every point he made because I'd just finished writing Missile Envy, so I was full of facts and figures and data, and everything he said to me was inaccurate. And when he got anxious, his cheeks would flush, if you remember, so I would hold his hand and pat his hand and calm him down. And so I think for half of the time, I held his hand, and we quickly established a doctor-patient relationship. And, you know, when you've got a patient, you have to assess their IQ to make sure they put their suppository in at 6 a.m. in the morning, you know, and make sure they know what they're doing. So I assessed his IQ to be about 100, really. But I also came out saying I think he had impending Alzheimer's, which he did. So, and interestingly, I thought I hadn't made the slightest bit of difference. But then he started to say nuclear weapons must never be used and nuclear war could never be won. And then he started working with Gorbachev, who actually heard the physicians talking about the medical effects of nuclear war on Moscow radio. And then he and Gorbachev met in Reykjavik, Iceland, where they almost agreed, two mere mortals almost agreed, to abolish nuclear weapons, which was an absolute precedent. So, you know, we helped to bring about the end of the Cold War, but unfortunately the weapons were still in place because Clinton dropped the bundle and he had 80% of Americans wanting him to get rid of the weapons, and he left them in place. If we have a nuclear war tonight, that is Clinton's legacy, for which I will never forgive him.
Well, you can also talk to him about Leonard Peltier, who he left in jail all these years, but we won't go there right now. Whenever I see Bill Clinton, I see Leonard Peltier in jail. The only thing that Bill Clinton ever accomplished in office, as far as I'm concerned, is to inaugurate a national dialogue on oral sex, but we won't talk about that now.
No, we won't talk about that.
So, Helen, do you, just for, you know, a little off the topic here, but many historians believe, and I've read two books that assert that Ronald Reagan, at the end of his term, was in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's and that Nancy was really running the country.
Yes,
what do you think about that?
Well, she was. It's the truth.
I think she did a good job, actually.
I remember
she's the one who ended the Cold War, don't you think?
No, she didn't. No. I remember he was being interviewed by the media, and he was very stumbly. And she whispered to him, just say we're doing the best we can. And he said, we're doing the best we can. Now, towards the end of his office, he was not quite all there, but he became much worse after he ceased to be president. And indeed, he died from Alzheimer's. He was a nice old man. I mean, he would have been a good, you know, owner of a chicken farm or a ranch or something, but certainly...
Well, he did own a ranch.
I know.
As a matter of
fact.
Totally
inappropriate to be president.
Right. So, Helen, we're down in this country now to 99 commercial reactors. There are about 400, well, actually less than 400 worldwide if you consider the, if you write off the 54 that were in Japan. And, you know, the one good thing, the only good thing that came from out of the Fukushima disaster is that the other reactors in Japan shut down and have been shut down, I believe, as a whole for more than a year. Now, the Japanese government...
No, for 3.5 years. They've all been shut down for 3.5 years.
No. They didn't all shut down the first year.
Oh.
You have to remember that they continued to run many of the reactors in Japan.
Okay.
Japan has a method, unlike the United States, where when they go down for refueling, the local government does have a say in whether they go back up. And so it took about a year for all the reactors in Japan to shut. But now, of course, the Abe regime is trying to force them to reopen.
So is the nuclear industry in America, incidentally, pressuring them to open their reactors.
Well, you know, yes, they are. And
I know that, course, because I've been in Japan 3 times in the last year.
I will never go to Japan again. I mean, I was there, I loved it there, but since Fukushima, yeah. I've been to Three Mile Island. I went to Three Mile Island a year after the accident. I went to Kiev 10 years after Chernobyl. I've done my time. I'm not going to Japan. I'm sure you learned a lot there. But I am hoping that we can keep that the Japanese people can keep the rest of those reactors shut for the duration. The question now in my mind, Helen, and I don't know, have you been to China, and what do you see about what's happening in China?
Okay, so I've been to Taiwan, and my book "Nuclear Power is Not the Answer" has been translated into Chinese, but I'm not sure if it will get to China. I really wish it would. Number one, it'd be great; it would be good for me. But number two, it would educate the Chinese about the dangers of nuclear reactors, and they tend to be building quite a few of them at the moment, which just makes me feel sick in the stomach, really sick. They're forging ahead on renewable energy, that's true. They're very worried about their coal-fired plants, although they're still constructing them, because people can hardly breathe now in Beijing in certain times of the year and other places. The pollution is so profound. So they're aware of what's happening, but, you know, they've become capitalists. And what can I say? I'm very worried about the future, Harvey.
Yes, I know that. So here in the United States, we have a little intramural activity going on. We have James Hansen and a few others who are, in the anti-global warming campaign, who are speaking as if nuclear power could have some sort of role to play.
I know.
Well, what would you say to them?
James Hansen went to Argonne National Labs for one weekend to a conference, and he came back incredibly enthusiastic about new reactors, small modular reactors, breeder reactors, fast reactors, and, you know, my respect for him has declined considerably as a scientist. One must never speak about things without having read all the literature, all the science, and understanding this truly complex technology to the nth degree. And so he doesn't know what he's talking about in this area. Neither does the guy in England. What's his name who started Gaia?
George Monbiot.
No, Lovelock. James Lovelock.
Oh, Lovelock, yes. Yeah. There's James Lovelock, and then there's a guy, George Monbiot, who's writing also, as if nuclear had something to do to help
George Monbiot said after Fukushima, he said, now after Fukushima, I'm in favor of nuclear power. I mean...
Well, you and I have been working to dump King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, and go to a totally green-powered Earth. And I must say you've been remarkably successful and effective. I remember your speech in 1978. You spoke at a concert with Jackson Browne and Graham Nash. And I don't know if you knew this, but Bruce Springsteen was in the audience. And after that concert, we recruited Bruce Springsteen, and he joined us at the Musicians United for Safe Energy concerts in New York City. So that was a big plus.
That's wonderful. I didn't know that.
Now, what organizations are you working with now? You're with Beyond Nuclear and...
No. I mean, I gave them my 501c3, so I'm their founding president, and they're doing a jolly good job. But I now have my own foundation called the Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear Free Planet, and you can Google that and find it. I'm also organizing a new symposium, Harvey. I have to go shortly, I have to tell you that, but I'm organizing a new symposium at the end of February for a weekend at the New York Academy of Medicine called The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction. And the reason I'm doing that is threefold. One, the administration has just announced they're going to spend $1 trillion on replacing every single nuclear weapon, missile, submarine, plane, you name it. Two, artificial intelligence is moving so rapidly that people like Stephen Hawking et al. Are now saying that within about 10 years, computers could start a nuclear war with no human input. And three, the situation in the Ukraine is very, very dangerous, and it's the first time since the Cold War ended that Russia and America are confronting each other militarily. So with that in mind, I've organized a symposium with just the best speakers that I can find in this country and throughout the world, and I'd invite you all to come.
I will come. What are the dates of this conference?
It's February the 28th, March the 1st.
Okay, and I will be there, and I will invite you into the PRN studio, and we will set it up. We'll talk to Gary Null, and we'll set it up to see how many of the speakers that you bring down there we can move in and put on PRN.
Excellent.
Who are some of the speakers that you have all so far?
Oh, I've got Noam Chomsky, Eric Schlosser, who wrote Command and Control about the near misses that we've had. Lynn Eden, who wrote a wonderful book about fire after nuclear war, which the Pentagon never takes into account. Massive firestorms throughout throughout the world, lofting radioactive elements and soot into the atmosphere, causing a short ice age, nuclear winter. I've got people from EKV, Pax Christi in, I think, Holland, who have written a wonderful report called Don't Bank on the Bomb, because many, many banks are involved in the nuclear weapons industry up to their necks, and this is an expose of what they're doing.
Sounds amazing.
Are
you going to turn the proceedings from this conference into another book with the new press?
Yes, probably we are.
Okay, so we just have 5 minutes left, Helen. I know you've got to go, and we're almost out of time. So tell us exactly what you want people to do and how we can reverse this insane course of extinction.
It's very important that people become well-informed and know what they're talking about. I'd invite them to go to my webpage, helencaldicott.com, and read as many of my books as you can. I'm not saying it's to sell my books, but they're fairly comprehensive. One is If You Love This Planet, which involves global warming, overpopulation, deforestation, desertification, toxic chemicals, you name it. One is called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. That's all the medical implications of nuclear power, from uranium mining right through to the storage of radioactive waste for 1 million years. One is called War in Heaven, which is happening now that Lockheed Martin and Boeing are arming the heavens to fight war from space. One is called Loving This Planet, about all the interviews I had for my 3.5 years of radio program, and I've interviewed some fascinating people, including a neurosurgeon who examined all the data relating to brain tumors developing from the use of cell phones. That's really fascinating. And lots of other stuff. So, I mean, read them, underline them, learn what I've written, like I learnt Grey's Anatomy to become a doctor. And
And Helen, I want to invite you on the gradually escalating focus on shutting the Diablo Canyon reactors in California. There are many others under attack from citizen action. But, there are a number of reactors in the United States now that are losing lots of money. And the great irony is that these legislatures, state legislatures, which support fracking and coal mining and oil drilling, are turning around and saying, well, we need to support these reactors to fight global warming. At least they have a sense of humor.
Well, I'll come and the Californian state legislature. I know Brown very well.
Well, Jerry Brown needs to be reached. We need
shut
these two reactors in California.
Me and I'll come out.
What's that again?
I said, organize it for me, and I'll come out and meet with Jerry and address the legislature.
All right, we'd like to do that. We'll put you down for August in California.
Okay.
And in the meantime, Helen Caldicott, you're a great global treasure. It's been wonderful having you on the air. Give us your book titles and your website again.
Okay, Crisis Without End. Two websites, HelenCaldicott.com and HelenCaldicottFoundation.org.
All right. Thank you so much, Helen Caldicott. And your conference now, tell us when and where the upcoming on...
February the 28th, March the 1st, at the New York Academy of Medicine, title, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction.
And all do you have a separate website for that one, or is that one...
No, that'll be on my foundation website.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Helen Caldicott. Keep up your great work. I will want to ask you more about Ronald Reagan at another point, but
okay.
I think we have more important things
to talk about. Quite a thing. Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you, and enjoy your grandchildren. This has been another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. It's been great to have Helen Caldicott on the air with us. Truly one of the great women of our time. And next week, we will be joined by Damon Moglen from Friends of the Earth and some other folks to talk about the shutdown of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Thank you so much to the crew in New York and to all our wonderful listeners here on PRN. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and we'll see you on the radio in another week.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia?